Hello and welcome to Shades and Layers. I'm your host, Kutlwano Skhosana Ritchie. We are continuing with our focus on fashion this season, and this week, my guest is Zuhaira Washington, President and COO of Otrium, a Dutch-born end-to-end marketplace that she calls the best-kept secret in fashion. Otrium is a digital platform where you can buy end-of-season clothing at accessible prices. And what does that mean? Well, all those clothes that brands were unable to sell for whatever reason can be discreetly uploaded onto the platform and given a second chance at finding their way to being bought and used, rather than ending up in a landfill or a burning pile. This, of course, should give you a hint that sustainability is one of the topics I discussed with Zuhaira. It is one of the many huge problems associated with the fashion industry, but things are starting to move in the right direction, and she will explain about that a little more during our interview. Zuhaira started her career in private equity. She has founded her own tech company before, has had a stint at Uber as well as Expedia, and now she is telling us about how she's leading Otrium's expansion into the US market. As usual, we start by describing the job itself and why it's so meaningful to our guest. So sit tight and enjoy this conversation with Zuhaira Washington.
My name is Zuhaira Washington. I am the president and COO of a company called Otrium, which is the best kept secret in fashion. What that means is I essentially partner with our CEO to drive our top line growth and bottom line profitability.
So you're the one who makes it happen.
I'm the connection between what we achieve, what we aspire to achieve, our long-term vision, and how that works day to day as it relates to our partnership team, our marketing team, our markets team, which looks at it from a geo perspective.
Good. So that's the practical side of what you do. What's the deeper meaning you attach to it? Why did you take this job?
Well, that is such a great question. I think, especially in this time and day and age, having a bigger why to work is so fundamental for so many people. Mm-hmm. You know, I think I started my career in public policy and politics because I thought that was the way to make an impact. Mm-hmm. And I think like many professionals in this day and age wanted to chart my own course in finding a way to create a bigger why with my work day to day. And for me, when I reflect on that, it means building big businesses with good people, right? That's like at the top of my list. We spend so much of our day in and day out at work.
Yeah.
The people that I work with, the humans that I work with, the individuals that I work with really matters to me. Mm-hmm. That was something that I did a lot of due diligence on before joining the company.
Yeah.
You know, who are the co-founders that I'm building with? Who are the leaders that they surround themselves with? And were we aligned from a values perspective, from an integrity perspective? Many people call that the culture, what's the culture of the company. But for me, that was probably at the top of my list in terms of determining how I was going to invest my life's energy and talent for my next opportunity. So that was definitely at the top of my list. And I think like many purpose-driven leaders in this day and age, there has to be a bigger why. So it's not just in like, can this be a big business and can it make lots of money? It's like, why are we building this? And what is the, net positive result we're looking to have on the world, right?
Yeah.
And for me, that was something that I really sat with for some time because that has to like connect dots for me. Mm. Every company that I've joined in the past, there's been a narrative, right, around what makes sense, even with Uber. Right. For me, that was about creating micro entrepreneurs and allowing, folks who, wanted to be entrepreneurs, wanted to have more control and flexibility, whether that was because they wanted the ability to pick up their kids after school or work later in the night or have more overall control of their financial stability. That is what really, kind of energized me around that role was how do we actually use this platform to empower people?
Right.
With Altrium, it's deeper and it's funny in some ways how this unfolds because I grew up as someone, I was raised by a single mother, this in the Black community, how you present yourself, what you wear, right?
Yeah.
Is a reflection of your own, perception of yourself, right?
Yes.
I like to say art, we say internally in the company that fashion is the world's largest art form. Right. Mm-hmm. But for Black people, I think it means more than that because there's so many institutional structures that try to tell us what we are.
Yes.
And our clothes are really ways to signal proactively what we believe to be true about ourselves. Right.
Right.
And like how we present. And so, I vividly remember growing up like shopping in what I now know as off-price channels like Ross and Marshall's, TJ Maxx. Not knowing, right? Those were off-price channels, mm-hmm. but it was a way to provide access, right? To these clothes that were coveted,
yes.
that were at a price point,
yes.
that weren't accessible, And I remember my mom, like she always dressed to the nines. Like she always, to
yeah.
this day,
yeah.
right?
It's yeah.
like dressed from head to toe. Like you will not tell me anything about what I have on. And what resonated with me about this mission in this company, which I didn't really fully appreciate, I think early on, was there was a pathway to provide access to brands and high quality, like fashion items at a price point that was accessible, right? To folks like me and my mom, right? Growing up or everyone, right? Still me,
right.
like the sweaters from a brand, right? Still me because who doesn't love a great brand at a great price? And to do it with a broader why, right? And a bigger purpose. And that second piece, which is about ensuring that our mission is all clothing items that are produced are worn, that everything that is created has a purpose and should be worn. Right.
Yeah.
Because there was creativity pouring into that. There was ingenuity pouring into that. There was material, right? And goods and thought and
Absolutely.
Hand.
Yeah.
Right. And so how do we honor that? And for us, it's really about this excess inventory, essentially providing clothes with the second chance. So there's a lot of buzz around, secondhand inventory, used
yeah.
inventory.
Yeah.
We really focus on items that have never been worn, right? That were created in excess of the demand. And now we want to find an owner for them. So it's not about secondhand. It's about second chance. It's an opportunity for people to own these items
right.
that have never been worn and to put them into use and to love them and to care for them.
Yeah, I think that's great because there was a time when you were hearing these stories about, brands like, putting their clothes in landfills because nobody
yes.
had bought them that season and sitting in yes. warehouses and gathering dust there.
Exactly. Or being burned or shipped mm-hmm. to developing countries, right?
Mm-hmm.
And all the resources that are involved in that. And you're exactly right. There are brands who have made choices that I think they would make differently today. And what we really want to do is provide a discrete channel for those brands to say, okay, we made too much, right? How can we discreetly distribute this excess in a way that is still on brand, but also ensures that they are worn? They're out there, they're utilized.
How does that work? Like, do they rebrand them when they get on your platform? There's a new
Ooh.
Entrepreneur. So yeah, how does it work? Yeah.
Yeah. So we are a B2B, B2C platform.
Mm.
And what that
okay.
is, we work directly with brands. So
mm-hmm.
we have an agreement with each brand that we work with. We contract with them and that contract determines what we call a revenue share. And they send us inventory and we agree upon how we will split the proceeds from that inventory when we sell it on our platform. But Altrium itself is a marketplace. We are not a
right.
brand per se. So we work with brands to sell their excess inventory on our platform. We specifically focus on customers that are price motivated, who are off-price customers. customers who are looking for that amazing deal. Mm-hmm. Customers who believe that out of season is not out of style, right? Their style is endless. It's effortless. Like, I don't know what season this sweater is from. I know that I love this color and it looks great on my skin tone, right? Mm-hmm. So like, mm-hmm. It resonates with me. So we do an agreement with the brands. They give us their excess inventory, and then we display that on our platform for the consumer. That's the B2C part.
Yeah.
We then show it to the consumer, and the consumer just knows, I know I can go to Otrium. It's my outlet in my pocket, right? Everything on that platform is directly sourced from brands, is high quality, mm-hmm. and is at a sharp price. And so we're a B2B to C platform. So we work throughout that entire life cycle to find the best end owner for excess inventory.
Yeah. And this is a first of its kind, I would imagine.
There are definitely offline players. If you've ever gone to mm-hmm. Nordstrom Rack, right? For example, mm-hmm. Seattle.
Yeah.
They have brick and mortar solutions. We are a digital solution. So the innovation is in the digital, the online segment. It's right. also in the way that we work. We are a revenue share model for brands. And so we don't just say, we'll buy this at 5 cents or 3 cents on the dollar. We say, let's put it up and whatever it sells at, we'll split the revenue. So it doesn't cap the upside for the brands. Whereas more of those traditional models, they are more of a stock buyer program. Mm-hmm. Where they cap the upside, and that upside is what they use to generate their own profit. We share the revenue with mm-hmm. our partner. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And where are you present? Which markets are you available?
Yes. Well, we are global. Our company started 7 years ago in Amsterdam. We are now present in London, in Germany, in Belgium. We launched the US a little over a year ago. Mm-hmm. It's our fastest growing market. We're in London. So it's really an exciting time for our company to be growing and scaling. But we are still in the U.S., I like to think, the best kept secret. So we are still very much on a growth trajectory here. Mm-hmm. And every time that I tell someone about what we're doing and what we're building, they're like, how have I not heard of this?
That's what I thought when I got that.
Exactly. So you're getting in on the early end. Well, hopefully a year from now, we'll chat.
Right.
And you'll
see. Right.
We're still the best kept secret in the U.S. Mm-hmm. On a massive, growth tear here to get the word out about our platform.
Yeah. So you've mentioned, the split revenue, and it's kind of a fair playing ground for both the brand and yourselves. I also see that you have an impact report on your website?
Yeah. So we want to be a net contributor from a solving the problems of the industry, right? So $2 trillion industry, we know 1 in 10 items goes not worn. We know about 12% of every item of all inventory that's produced is not worn. And so what we want to do is really have a positive impact in reducing the amount of items that either get sent to landfills or burned. Right. So we're only dealing in the excess inventory lane. We've been, maybe this is Dutch to our early conversation, internally close to the chest as it relates to our sustainability metrics, because we don't just want the vanity metrics. We want to really know that what we're doing is having an impact. So in April of this year, we are actually going to be releasing broader statistics around our impact mm-hmm. in a way that we all feel is like at the highest bar, because that's really important, not only to me, but to our co-founder, Max, to ensure that we're not just like adding our voice to the chorus of brands that I feel like these days are saying do, right?
Yeah.
But really deeply understand the impact that we're having. And so it's important to us to know that. So we're taking the time to make sure that we have those metrics we can tick and tie.
Do you think that big brands walk the talk when it comes to all these metrics that are sustainability related?
I think there's more and more pressure from the consumers, from boards to walk the talk, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a good thing for all of us, not just for the brands, but for the broader environment. I think everyone is getting more savvy in how they determine like what is real change and what is real impact. And also calling out the BS, right? So I think this is the beginning of a shift in the broader industry of holding all of us to a higher bar, not only the brands, but consumers, right?
Yeah.
Consumers want to know, right? You know, I remember early in my journey, again, being someone who loves great style at a great price, shopping at some places that I don't shop at today, some of the fast fashion companies.
Right.
I wasn't fully educated on, you know, their ways of working, you know, their values, the way that they have an impact on the environment. And once I became more aware, I shifted my behaviors. And I think we're on the beginning of that journey where customers are becoming more aware, mm-hmm. right? They're being more prudent. They're voting with their dollars. And they're holding the companies that they do business with to a higher bar. Mm-hmm. And I think we all benefit from that.
Yeah. This is Shades and Layers. My guest today is Zuhaira Washington, President and COO of the Dutch-founded Otrium end-to-end marketplace with a mission to change how clothes are produced and bought. In the next part of our conversation, she talks about her very first business, becoming an angel investor, her leadership style, and what she would encourage you to do for a successful career. First up, Zuhaira tells us about her observations, the similarities and differences between digital platforms in fashion and the tech companies where she worked previously. So what's been the most surprising thing about working in fashion industry, having come from, you know, private equity and Uber and, you know, Expedia?
Probably two observations. One, the lack of data in fashion. I think because it's primarily a creative industry.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
There, people are used to not having as much data at their fingertips. And I think by design, a technology company, you know, you have that, right? That's like mm-hmm, in mm-hmm. DNA, right? To be data driven. So I think a lot of our brands have been pleasantly surprised with the amount of data that we provide via our B2B platform and the information and insights we give to them. That's just not generally available mm-hmm. in the industry. So I'd say that's one. And then I think two, there's a lot of similarity between travel and fashion. I think that was a surprise to me because a lot of the travel companies are brands.
Right.
You know, they're selling this aspiration. They're selling, right, this lifestyle.
Yeah.
Right. And so I have found a lot of similarity in terms of some of the narrative that our brands have around wanting to consistently ensure that they're preserving their brand equity, right? Mm-hmm. And wanting to make sure that they're, you know, constantly driving incrementality as it relates from a customer base.
Right.
I think that's probably something I didn't necessarily anticipate, but I see coming through mm-hmm. in our discussions and, you know, conversations with brands about how they view their business. And how they look at doing business with a platform like
this. Interesting. Yeah. And, you know, having come from another tech company, which was your first business, how are you applying the knowledge that you gathered from that first venture to this current situation?
Are you talking about Canoodle?
Canoodle, yes. I love it.
Thank you for giving Canoodle some life on Valentine's Day, indeed. Canoodle was a company that I started with the intuition. As I mentioned, I was raised by a single mother. Mm-hmm. I didn't grow up in a two-parent household, and that's always been an aspiration for me. So when I met my amazing husband, mm-hmm. Mark, I didn't want to F it up. And yeah. So I read every book possible about how to make relationships successful because I was like an A-plus student, but like I didn't really have a lived experience on how to make relationships work. Mm-hmm. And as I was reading these books, I was like, there should be an app for this. Like, how has no one thought of this? Like, and so I built a business around it. And it's funny how it applies now. One of my key learnings at Canoodle was a fewfold. One was the concept of love languages, which is, I don't know if you've heard of that book, The Five Love Languages. And I think that helps in building a remote first international global company, which is understanding how each, individual or country communicates and meeting them where they are. So the concept of love languages is that while my love language may be words of affirmation and my husband's may be acts of kindness, when I'm trying to demonstrate love to him, I need to do so in a way that is speaking his language.
Exactly.
And how that's applied to Otrium is really in the global context, me always doing a bit of a gut check in when we're communicating globally with teams, like, okay, are we speaking the same language? Where is there a disconnect? How can I drive for clarity? Where can I limit misinterpretation? And so I think that helps me as a global leader, right? Thinking about cultural differences. Another way is another key learning from Canoodle and the research that I did in building that company was really the concept of 5-to-1 ratio, which is the Gottman Institute, which is actually this couple of psychologists who've researched what makes couples. How can you indicate whether or not couples? You sound like you're familiar with it.
Lady, I've been in this marriage thing for like 11 years.
Well, we're there with each other. So, you know, the 5-to-1 rule, which is, you know, 5 positive, points of praise to 1 criticism. And I think that's even more important in remote first cultures because we forget that, like, I don't know what your experience is, but in many remote cultures, you're like, you have a meeting, there's an objective, there's a set moment of time. There's not a lot of that like fluid, like, oh, let's just hang out. Let's just like, you know, have the water cooler conversation. So you need to be even more intentional with your praise, right? Because probably like most high performers, you're constantly thinking about what can we be doing better? And so I find that reminder myself is like, how can I catch people doing goodness? Right. How can I catch them doing good things versus bad things?
Exactly.
And then voice that out loud and like celebrate that because the human psychology of 5 points of praise and affirmation to 1 point of criticism is really important in terms of building a high performing culture because to the Dutch point, you want to be direct when you find that one, right? You want to be able to build a culture that is psychologically safe where you can call out the one, but you also don't want to, you know, put blind eyes over the 5 things that the team is doing well. And so I'm constantly calibrating,
right?
And trying to catch, our team's doing great things so I can celebrate it even in small ways, right? If it's during Slack and like, you know, just doing the like high five, you know, or you know, Google Meets and like the celebratory, confetti, right? Like I'm looking for ways to be able to do that so we can also take the moments where we need to redirect when things aren't going as well to do that in a way that feels empowering and also like I'm leaning in a caring way.
Yeah. So I'm hearing emotional intelligence, intentionality, purpose. What's the other characteristic of your leadership style?
Authenticity. Mm-hmm. I think it's really hard for me to show, be two-faced is the term.
Right.
It's like what you see is what you get and like either like it or you don't. and it's really hard for me to navigate in places where people aren't at one with who they are, right? And I'll be transparent, like you have to do the self-work to first know who you are, right? And be comfortable enough in showing that in a transparent and authentic way. But that's something I've done and continue to do work on, right? Which is constantly evaluating and getting to know myself so that I can show up in a way that is connected, right?
Right. Would you ever start your own company again?
Oh my God, such a great question. Maybe. I know that it's easier said than done, right? Like, I feel like being an entrepreneur, being a founder is so glorified. And I think if you've done it, and in my case, you've done it and not been successful at it, it humbles you, right? Yeah. And so for me, it would take something that I'm really, really passionate about and also feel uniquely qualified to deliver on. Yeah. So maybe.
maybe. And what business would you think about going into? Like, what are you passionate about?
Yeah, I would say it's hard. I think this is why I haven't started my own company because a lot of the work that I'm doing myself now is about how do I become a better partner? How do I become a better parent? Right. How do I become a better human? And so it's all in those buckets. And mm-hmm. so a lot of my ideas and innovations are really in those buckets, and they're not, it's self-work, right? And some of those things are worthy of like scalable products or systems. Mm. Right? And I'm okay with that, right? Because I feel like, I guess one of my core beliefs is that we're all here to evolve, right?
Yeah.
And like, if I'm doing that work, then that's what I'm here to do. And yeah. if that shows up in a business that's scalable and multi millions or billions of dollars, so be it. And if it shows up at me just being a better parent and partner, then so be it.
Yeah. Or a little bird told me, that little bird is LinkedIn, that you're an angel investor.
Yes.
Tell me yes. how you got into that.
It's so funny because it's such a like, I remember when I was a founder and I was looking for angel investors, like someone to write me a check to help me, you know, get to the next level for my business. I kind of fell into it because after Uber, I had a little bit of liquidity and mm-hmm. I was able to put my money behind some of the individuals who I felt were building generational businesses that I wanted to be a part right. of. Mm-hmm. And so I find it a really fortunate position to be able to support right. either individuals I've known personally mm-hmm. who I really want to be part of, you know, the companies that they're building mm-hmm. or just ideas that I feel like the world needs. Right. And I don't take that for granted. I don't take that for granted at all to be mm-hmm. able to do that. So, like mm-hmm. it's a very privileged and fortunate position that I enjoy.
Yeah. And where did you learn about becoming an angel investor? And, you know, how did you build up that skill set?
You know, it's a great question. I didn't learn in a separate angel investor course, mm-hmm. although there are some like Pipeline Angels, right? Which is a great mm-hmm. program that teaches mm-hmm. it. It's really about me betting on my own intuition and gut. So there's nothing more than that. There's an investment committee of two, myself and my husband, right? We like look at them and, you know, we have debates around, you know, this is the founder, this is the opportunity. And it's really about a way for me to make bets on either businesses or individuals.
Right.
I didn't take a course or anything. It's really, it's not more complicated than that.
Yeah. And, you know, you've had this amazing career trajectory and, you know, you're heavily invested in everything that you get involved in. So if someone wants to emulate your career, where would you advise them to start?
Don't emulate my career. Well, what I would just say is like, my career is not one that you can, I'm going to do this step and then this step and then this step, because mm-hmm. that's not how I built it. I built it by making mistakes and learning and pivoting and getting closer to what was really important to me. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what other folks should do as well. Right. Mm-hmm. I remember, when I was in graduate school reading, you know, books and stories and interviewing people about their careers and like, can I find people like me? And if anything, I would want to be that example of like a real person that people feel like they can connect with.
Right.
But not that folks would say, okay, she spent 2 years here and she got this degree and she did this. Mm-hmm. Because I think those decisions are like very personal.
Yep.
And they need to come from within. They can't be just like cookie cutter replicated.
Right.
And so that's what I would say. Like, I hope in some ways for some people, I am an inspiration to chart your own course, not to cookie cutter replicate what I did. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Shades and Layers is all about celebrating Black women entrepreneurs and other game changers. And today's guest is Zuhaira Washington, who has a Harvard MBA and a bachelor degree from UCLA. Earlier, she hinted as to what it was that made her such a high achiever. And now it's time to find out more about that. And as usual, we have our rapid fire about memoirs and biopics.
So you mentioned that you come from a single parent household. And, yes. You know, that, of course, has shaped how things have unfolded for you. But, you know, do you have any memories, not necessarily only from childhood, but, you know, it could be from college or whenever, that have been instrumental in how or where you found yourself right now?
Yes. I mean, no discredit to the men in my family, but the women in my family have consistently just been a bright spot in my memory and shaping of me, you know, my mother to my grandmother, to what I'm learning about my great grandmother. It's been so important. And the narrative is really one about resilience. Right. And, you know, making a way out of no way, out of facing tough times head on and seeing a way through. And it's something I've really been reflecting on because it's so core to who I am. I'm not only an optimist, but I'm someone who, you know, gets more energized the tougher the problem becomes. And it's something that as I reflect, I feel like is not just around like who I am, but I think it's part of my DNA. I've been spending a lot of time on is really understanding the matriarchs in my family. So my my husband gifted me a genealogy, you know, kind of for my birthday. And so I've been learning a lot more about my great grandmother, my great great grandmother, and their stories. And there are stories of resilience, right? There are stories of insurmountable, you know, just kind of adversity, whether it's, you know, death in the family or abuse or racism or sexism. I'm still eking out a way of survival. And what I'm really reflecting on now is like, what is my role in that narrative and lineage? And it's kind of a tricky thing because I think there's so much around like the strong Black woman, you know, we do everything, we hold it on our shoulders. And one of the kind of more radical ideas I've been sitting with is, you know, I think the narrative I've told myself for so long is like, the concept of, you know, we are our ancestors' wildest dreams.
Right.
Is this concept of like, what if our ancestors' wildest dreams was for us to rest? Right.
Yeah.
Was for us to actually take a break and not run at, you know, 2000, to not have everything on our back, to have a leisurely stroll, right? To have Sunday off.
Right.
And that's kind of the space that I'm trying to balance between like the drive that I have, the responsibility that I feel to, you know, to like represent and do more, but also to find a space for myself, to, re-energize, right? And how does that play? Yeah. And the broader narrative. And so, I am consistently learning from the matriarchs in my family.
Yeah.
What they sacrifice to to develop this little Zahara that is today. And also thinking about how to rewrite that story, right? For my daughter, who's just turned 3 on Friday.
I see.
What I hope for her. Absolutely.
Yeah. And, you know, if you had to gather those thoughts in a book, what would that memoir be called and why?
The first thing that comes to me is All of Me, because it's not just one narrative. It's a nuanced, complex narrative. And it's also a story about, you know, self-love and evolution, right? In all components.
Right.
And I think that's the human journey. I think oftentimes we oversimplify, like this person's a success and this person's a failure. And my story is much more complicated. You know, there's many more ebbs and flows. And I think we need to create space for that, particularly among Black women, right? To share the stories and the nuance of it. And so, yeah, Yeah,
that's why Shades and Layers exist.
Yay!
Who would you pick to play the lead actress in your biopic?
I don't have a good answer for this. There's so many people. Kerry Washington, maybe.
Yeah, I can see that.
You know, she's probably at the top of the list.
Right, right. Perfect, perfect. And where can people find you online?
ZaharaWashington.com or Otrium.com.
Great. And that is all from me this time around. Thank you, Zuhaira, for sharing your story. Thanks to you for listening. Please share this episode with a friend. And if this episode was shared with you, then go ahead and subscribe or support the Shades and Layers podcast wherever you listen. I'm Kutlwana Skhosana Richie, and until next time, please do take good care.